Tonight on Arena, Mary Morrissey and Grainne Murphy on their Cork connections and Cork stories, and Elizabeth Moynihan and her place Celebrity, set in 17th century Rome. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Edited by Madeline Darcy and Laura McKenna, Cork Stories is a new anthology of short stories from Dura Press, a company with form in this area, having already published Belfast Stories and two volumes of Galway Stories. The foreword to this new connection, Cork Stories, opens with the line, "Everyone in Cork has a story." And sure enough, there's an impressive roll call of writers to prove it, from Danielle McLaughlin through to Kevin Barry. And the two writers who join me this evening, Mary Morrissey and Grainne Murphy, both of whom have stories in the collection. And where else would they be joining me from other than their Cork studios? Our Cork studios, rather. Let us get the qualifying criteria out of the way, first of all, for both of you. Mary, the connection and the claim to Corkonianism.
Well, I'm a dub, but and I won't ever be forgiven for that. But I've been in Cork about 20 years, so I've been given a temporary visa for this, I think.
And do you have to stay a lot longer than 20 years to get anything beyond the temporary visa, do you think?
I don't know. The next 20 years will tell.
And what about you then? I think you might be a little bit closer to home than that, Grainne, are you?
I am. I grew up in West Cork in Kilmichael and lived in the city for university and that sort of thing. And I've been living in Belgooly now, down near Kinsale, for a lot of years.
So you have a full visa at this point in
time? I do. Yeah. I do. Card carrying.
All right. Well, you might give Mary hints on how she might achieve hers as the next two decades progress. Now, having said that, the introduction, this is Madeline Darcy and Laura McKenna's introduction to the collection, starts with, you know, everybody in Cork has a story. In fact, I think that's Patricia Looney's line, isn't it? Yeah, Patricia Looney, the acting County Cork City librarian, gives us the foreword. Then in the introduction, we get a line which I really liked from Madeline Darcy and Laura McKenna. "The stories in this anthology are all set in Cork, the largest county in Ireland with the longest coastline and a great variety of landscapes, townscapes and seascapes." And of course, those claims are absolutely correct. I suppose, Mary, what that tells us is there are a great variety of locations and types of Cork that are represented in this collection.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, country and city. But also, I think, you know, there's a huge range of stories, different kinds of stories, different lengths of stories in this anthology. And I think it shows the kind of elasticity of the form, not just in terms of the places that are the stories are set in, but in terms of how the stories are put together. And of course, with an anthology, you always have that wonderful kind of bounce effect that you get 18 stories, separate stories written separately, and you put them together and they suddenly start speaking to one another.
Are you a bouncer when it comes to anthologies, Mary, or are you start at point A and make your way through to point Z?
Oh, no, I bounce around. I go for titles, actually, a lot of the time. And I think, you know, this collection has a whole load of sort of maybe unintended connections, but I think that's the treat of it.
Yeah, and I suppose the order in which you read things often makes those connections for you, the reader, which would be very different from somebody else's. Are you a bouncer too, or a dipper? What way do you go about things?
No, I'm very much a rule follower. Yeah, so I start at the start and keep going until the end. I always sort of feel that the editors, and in this case Madeline and Laura, who did such a wonderful job with the collection, that they have chosen the order for me. So, you know, I'm happy to follow their design of the stories and to see the connections that they want, and then to go back and reread in whatever order I want.
Are you the only person in Cork who follows rules?
I don't know. I'm certainly trying to raise a couple more.
All right. Let us go to the specifics of both of your stories. Your own story, Mary. A couple of wonderful connections in this, indeed, I felt as I read through it. But lost property is very much to the fore. Tell us a little bit about our heroine, or our protagonist who brings us through the story. We see everything through the eyes of Carmel Drummy.
Yes, I don't know that we could call her a heroine, you know, but she is the main character, and she's the wife of a businessman who goes bankrupt and sells the family home over her head, and he sinks the proceeds in Carmel's name into a penthouse apartment in the Elysian, which is a very tall tower building, quite controversial in its time in Cork, tallest building in Cork. And most people would be very happy with that situation, but Carmel is raging and furious at Ray because of her connection with the family home, which he has sold in order to do this.
The other aspect of Carmel, I think, is the fact that she has, I can't remember exactly what way you put it, but she has kind of lived the middle part of her life, or middle part of the middle years of her life, around night classes.
Yes, she's, I suppose you could say she's undereducated and is very, very hungry for knowledge and learning. And so she is an inveterate night class attender. And it really is what defines her. And also it's a way of making up for the home that she's come from, where there wasn't education and there wasn't refinement and there wasn't money. So she's making up for a lot of lacks in her life.
How long have you been, since you're 20 years already in Cork, have you been waiting to use that wonderful potential mix-up stroke pun of Corkonians and Cork onions, which you used to great effect in the telling of the story? You might explain how it's there, first of all.
Well, she attends in a night class which is called Historic Corkonians. And as soon as I wrote the word Corkonian, it really just occurred to me when I wrote it down. I thought, oh, it looks just like Cork onions. It isn't something that I've been storing up. It did just actually come
just
at the
fell
moment.
Out, fell, yep. Fell out onto the page. And the particular night class, I think, that she's just finished up brings us to Lichfield College and a very famous Corkonian.
Yes. At the start of the story, she is going to an open house, a house that's being sold, called Lichfield Cottage, and it's where George Boole lived, who was kind of the founder of computerization in a way. Because she has been to her night class, she knows all about George Boole. In fact, she knows much more about George Boole than the estate agent who's selling the house. So she, as the self-educated often do, she wants to show off. So she tells him a thing or two about Boole.
Yeah, well, he probably deserves to be told a thing or two. the same particular character. However, that Boolean aspect of things is quite interesting, because you also develop that further into the fact that maybe not as many people who don't know their Cork onions or their Corkonians would know that Boole's wife was an equally brilliant mathematician.
Absolutely. And, they produced a family of five daughters, all of whom were extraordinarily clever and very involved in the mathematical area. And that has continued on down the generations. His grandsons are very much involved in, one of his grandsons very much involved in the whole AI controversy. In fact, he resigned from Google because he didn't agree with the use of AI. So they were a very, a very intellectual family.
Yeah, very.
And yes, his wife was a mathematician and helped him a great deal in the writing of the books. It's not clear how much, but I mean, she was more than a wife. She was a kind of a work colleague for him as well.
And interesting, I mean, this is something that I think has interested you in other work, The Rising of Bella Casey, the novel that we spoke to you about some time back, she being Sean O'Casey's sister, am I right in thinking that, and Penelope Unbound, where I think you look at perhaps those who are often sidelined in the telling of the story of the big hero of the piece. So there is a kind of a gendered aspect, I thought, in that telling of the Boolean story that you do in the story. And I thought that I was interested in how, in your story, Gráinne, it might not spring to mind that you would be the obvious person to take on the voice of a widower. Tell us a little bit about your character in Nothing Sure, John. Mm-hmm. Quite an isolated and lonely individual who you treat, I have to say, as I read through, I felt with a kind of a tenderness and real loving care.
I love a lonesome character. And it's one of the reasons I think he fits really nicely in a story set in Kinsale, set at the end of October, because there's a particular lonesomeness about a grey seaside town at the tail end of October that really comes to mind very easily for people. So John is a retired man who's living alone after the death of his wife. And he was always very certain of his place in the world, was always quite correct in the way that he did things, you know, had his routines, and now left to his own devices, he's very much trying to build a sort of a scaffolding that'll take him through his day. So whether it's the time of the day that the radio goes on, or the time of the day he leaves to walk down to the hotel to get his dinner, or he goes to visit the graveyard or whatever, he has all of his routines still in place as if he was still working. One of the things, I suppose, that I was thinking about writing the story was that loss of routine and the things that we do to put that back in place for ourselves when it's not there externally anymore. And of course, we all had that experience during COVID where suddenly we were left to our own devices and we had to find ways of parceling out the time. And for this man in particular, he's very much just trying to get himself in a way that feels productive to him from the morning through to the night time.
And, you know, you say that you like the isolated, you like the lonely character.
I do.
That kind of appeals to you in some ways. Writers often talk about the, you know, various characters who will insist on having their story told. What was the nature of John in that respect to you? Was he a knocker on your desk on a regular basis, or a knocker on your writer's head on a regular basis? Or did he just gently sit there until you took notice of him?
Yeah, I think he was very much hovering around in the background, maybe doing his few jobs, you know, until I noticed. Yeah, for sure.
And getting his voice in that respect, in that regard, was it just the same as finding any character's voice? The fact that he was a man, it was irrelevant, I suppose, in many ways, was it?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't tend to picture my characters very easily, but I tend to hear them. So usually if I'm writing something, it'll start with maybe a line of dialogue or just knowing how a character feels about something. I tend to write, this isn't terribly technical, I tend to write characters from the inside out. So like living inside their head rather than kind of their external experience, so to speak. I could hear him, I guess, fairly easily.
And a nice cork lilt to his voice, was there?
There was, of course.
That elasticity that you spoke about earlier on, Mary, in terms of the short story form, you I think possibly I'm right in thinking that your second choice of story, Martina Evans's story, Knock, is in fact the shortest piece in the collection. I think it's only a couple of pages long, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, it manages to do that thing that a really great short story does, is that it immerses you completely in this world, dips you right into the centre of it. And, you know, it stays in your memory afterwards. I mean, one of the reasons I chose this too is that it's a historical short story. It's built on a stray remark from Ernie O'Malley's memoir about a man on the run who decried a household where he felt the woman of the house was stingy, and when he was asked how he liked his eggs, he said, "Rubbing up against a few others, thanks." And Martina has created a story of that woman, you know, so it's the War of Independence seen from the woman's point of view, and, you know, she resents these fellas marching in and expecting to be fed and watered and looked after. And it's just the voice of it and the language. Of course, Martina is a poet, so the language in it is really delicious. You know, there are some fantastic images, like the memory of the landlord coming with the gun broken over his arm, and you suddenly see it immediately. Yeah. And there's a wonderful sort of description of her boots with the tongues hanging out, and somehow it just creates a whole atmosphere. And there's also a kind of a mystery at the end of it, because she decides to kind of take her own back against Coughlin, the character who's quoted at the beginning. And she mentions that, you know, in I think it's the hotel in Cork. It's gone out of my head. You know, the chefs would spit in the soup if the customers were badly behaved.
Yes.
So she takes that as her lead and she says, you know, I wonder what they'll think of what I put in the bed, because Coughlin is, she's been removed from her bed and Coughlin is sleeping in it. And so you're thinking, crikey, what did she put in the bed?
And oftentimes what you imagine is much more frightening or even better than what is stated. If it's not stated, there's more room for the reader.
But what she does is she leaves the mystery. She leaves you to decide what it is she's done.
Absolutely, and therefore you're very invested because you're part of the making of the story as a reader.
Yes.
Sean Tanner's story, Black Dog Running, was one of the ones that you chose. What was it about this? Tell me about Sean Tanner, first of all, a little bit about him, Grainne.
Yeah, Sean is a short story writer from Cork. He's also a playwright, but his short fiction has been published in the Irish Times and the Stinging Fly and London Magazine. And he won the Hennessy First Fiction Award, I think, a couple of years ago. And his plays have been put on in Dublin and in Kilkenny. And he has a really wonderful use of natural language. His story just really flows beautifully. You can hear it very, very easily. And it's very familiar in its language and in its tone, but then every so often there'll be this little kick or this little flick of something that, you know, having read it, that you're going to hold on to it. So his story, Black Dog Running, is funnily enough about a sort of a lonesome older gentleman who has lost himself. Basically, after 30 years working in the same factory, he was let go and he doesn't have a job anymore, and he's really struggling to deal with that. And he's alternately, he says he's a bit low, or he's, you know, a bit down on himself. So very much not sort of confronting what it is that has happened and using every excuse in the book.
Yeah. It's one of the things that struck me. I mean, what Sean Tanner does here, sometimes, you know, he gets rid of some of the easy assumptions that can be made about these things. Things like alcohol as a coping mechanism, going to the GP to keep his wife quiet, exercise as the cure to everything. He comes up, eventually he brings us to this word and this emotion, or if that's the right way to describe it, shame. Shame
Absolutely.
Is vital to this story.
It is. It's the central thing, and it's something, I suppose, that's often very central to the Irish psyche, and it's something that we're all quite familiar with, shame in all its different ways. So he does, he takes us really neatly through all of the different coping mechanisms, I suppose, that people use when they've lost themselves a little bit. So whether it's, you know, the whiskey or the insomnia and all of that. And then just getting to the heart of cutting through the shame of it. And that's where, so the first step, I suppose, towards Pat, the main character, feeling better is getting rid of the shame. And that's really important, I think.
How important is that, or what does the Carrigaline setting of this story give to it? That, you know, as I mentioned, it is the biggest county and it has the longest coastline, I think I'm right in saying that. Or I'm presuming that both Madeline and Laura are right in saying that. It certainly has a variety of towns along its coastline. But what specifically does Carrigaline give to this particular story, do you think?
I think the idea that he worked for a very long time in a factory, and the idea of prosperity that came very quickly to a place and transformed it and then left possibly just as quickly. So this idea that the factory closed down and all of the jobs are gone, and all of the kind of the shiny glow that everybody had for so long and all the nice things, there are a lot of people left in the wake of that now with just this sort of greyness, and he says time is all he's left with now and he has nothing to fill it, you know.
Having read through the collection, or I'm sure a lot of the collection in both of your cases, have you come out at the end with what we might define? Is there a specific quality that makes something a Cork story, Mary Morrissey, first of all? You know, I'm not just talking about location and setting and maybe tone of voice and the lovely lilt that might be there in the accent. Did you come up with something that kind of unified the collection for you, Mary?
Well, I don't know. You shouldn't be asking a dub this question. But, as I say, I think it has more to do with the short story itself. I mean, in some stories, for example, in Martina's story, the location is barely there. Mm. In fact, the hotel in Cork is the only specific reference, you know, so some of the stories are like that, that they could be anywhere, so that they're universal as well as being local. But even the more localized ones, I think, can say, you know, are about the human condition and, you know, as Frank O'Connor would have it, the lonely voice, you know, the individual on the periphery, you know.
And indeed, I suppose Frank O'Connor, no mean exponent of the short story himself, obviously the Cork connection there. Did you feel you had something at the end of it that unified the collection for you, Grainne?
I suppose the collection, Madeline and Laura, have done a lovely job in balancing the urban and the rural. And it was tempting to read it in that sort of way, that, you know, the urban stories were maybe more an individual against the world, whereas the rural stories were a little bit more family based, maybe, or what we owe to each other. I think across the board, there was a sort of a man-made shambles kind of an idea going on, and a lot of weary women. But I think the dark humour really kind of carries it through. Una Montague's story has a lovely question in it, her story Dog Collar. And the central question of that is, are you happy? And I think that could have applied to any of the stories in the collection. And I think the answer, I suppose, maybe coming through in the Cork humour is, well, you know, I may not be happy, but I'm from Cork, you know.
Well, that puts you and me in our place, Mary, I think. By the way, the Victoria, I was just checking it for you there. I couldn't get it quick enough myself. The Victoria Hotel is the title of the hotel in Martina Evans's story. Well, thank you both so much for joining with us this evening and giving us your thoughts on the stories and collection. And good luck, Mary, with the next 20 years of qualifying for your permanent visa.
Thank you. The work starts here, Sean.
Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Grainne.
Thanks, Mary as well. Mary Morrissey and Grainne Murphy there speaking to us about Cork Stories, edited by Madeline Darcy and Laura McKenna, which is published by Dira Press. Now, it might be hard to think back to the Renaissance time and realise that artists like Michelangelo, Caravaggio, Leonardo da Vinci and many others were the celebrities of their day, like movie stars, writers, TikTok stars are today. Well, actor and playwright Elizabeth Moynihan has decided to explore the notion of celebrity in the context of the Italian Counter-Reformation, when Pope Urban VIII enlisted the artistic and architectural skills of the artist Gian Lorenzo Bernini to give the Vatican a kind of a facelift. Urban, the Pope, believed that this would appeal and grow his Catholic following and show up the Protestant aesthetic as dull and unambitious. But Bernini was a man of many passions, and his lust for one Constanza Bonarelli, the wife of his assistant, threatened to ruin his career. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Elizabeth Moynihan. It really is an extraordinary little story.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I was kind of thinking, well, where did you start here? And it is Urban, is it Urban? Do you say Urban?
Urban the Eighth. And the last Urban ever was.
Right, yeah. Okay. So I thought, well, where do you start here? Urban, did you start with him? Did you start with Bernini, hugely important, particularly in the area of sculpture? Or were there other things that attracted you into this lustful tale?
Well, my way in was Bernini. An actor pal lent me a book on him because he had a little bit of an obsession with him. And then the actress Joan Sheehy, when I was talking about Bernini, she said, oh, I've got a series by Simon Sharma, which has one documentary on him. Would you like me to lend it to you? And it was back in the days of videotapes. So that's how far back my, I suppose, inspiration
interest.
Interest, you know, was first triggered, if you like. And so that's how I got into it. It was through the Simon Sharma documentary.
And then you found both Costanza. Luigi and Costanza. It was Costanza,
yeah,
who is the wife of Bernini's assistant.
Matteo, who was himself, most of the assistants to the greats were all sculptors themselves, waiting for a commission, trying to find their feet, trying to get in with the papacy, whoever was in power at the time, plus ça change. So basically, he became obsessed with this woman, Costanza, and she was his undoing and his brother's undoing, because they both got involved with her. And women at the time were lent out by their husbands to more powerful men to gain political favour or financial favour. And so it was quite commonplace for a man to hand over his wife, which is what happened in this instance. However, I have a very thin template to work from historically. So I had to fill in the dots using my own imagination.
Well, I was going to say, you had to fill in the dots, or perhaps you could fill in the dots as you saw fit, which kind of possibly released you off out into another story. But that possession of the wife is quite an interesting dynamic within all of this. Matteo, it has to be said, not the most interesting man in the world.
No, but I've given him a secret, and that is revealed through the play. So we make him much more interesting than he is on the page, and the lovely Kieran Roach plays the part of Matteo, and he gives him such depth and duplicity that it's just really...
You have to flesh these characters out.
Oh, yeah.
So you're not going to get yourself bogged down in, am I being absolutely true to the historic tale here?
Brian Friel said that of his own translations, not that I'm comparing myself to the great Brian Friel or anything like it, but he said that translations was good drama and bad history. Now, I hope mine isn't bad history, but it's not... I've messed with timelines. You know, the Baldacchino was built in the 1620s.
So a little bit earlier than this period.
Yes. So I've kind of insinuated it into the 1630s for the purpose of the play.
And I suppose that the big issue here is in terms of the overall tale, if you like, is how important, how the Counter-Reformation and Urban VIII in particular used art as a way of really highlighting this Counter-Reformation trend within the church.
Well, they were also particularly Urban. He was all about fortification and arms and all kinds of political shenanigans. And he thought that he would stop Catholics from defecting to the Reformed Church, is what the Protestants call it, Protestantism, by encouraging Catholics to be more pious through incredible beauty and wealth within the church. So they were overawed or opiated, I think, isn't it? Karl Marx said religion is the opiate of the people. So it was that sort of thinking that Urban was exercising, if you like.
Yeah, so Urban and Bernini then was the favourite at court. And Bernini, in terms of sculpture and architecture, was the big artist of
Since
the time.
Since he was 10 years old. The Pope, the previous Pope, Paul the Fifth, he was an advocate and a patron of Bernini. Bernini's first sculpture went on display, according to some of my research, when he was 10 years old, the Faun. I mean, can you imagine a 10-year-old creating
just being capable of that, yeah.
And he didn't die until he was in his 80s. So he had 70 years of work. But this all but ruined him. He was sent into the wilderness by the next Pope, Innocent, because he almost bankrupted the Catholic Church. Yeah. And Urban along with him. Urban nearly bankrupted the Catholic Church at the time.
However, one of the hugely interesting dynamics here is Constanza.
Absolutely.
And the brilliance of this woman, both in artistic terms
and
in her capabilities of working within the political sphere that she found herself.
Absolutely, Sean. I mean, when you think about the women of the time, they didn't read. They weren't allowed to go anywhere unchaperoned. Literally, you couldn't go to a cafe if there was such a thing. And she was considered, at the end of her life at 42, one of the greatest art collectors of the time. She made a lot of money, and she'd had her face slashed under the direction of Bernini because he was so jealous of her relationship with his brother. And it was common practice to disfigure women like that at the time.
Which is frightening resonances in today's world.
Randomly, a woman could have her face slashed. It's a bit like, I suppose, you could put it into the context of acid attacks on women in our contemporary world. So, and the Sicilians used to cut the women's noses off, so that they would look like they were syphilitic and nobody would go near them. And they were sent to prison if they were adulterers, even though most of them were being sex trafficked, they were being gaslit, they were being abused, passed around. Yeah, so...
And Constanza, in this case, played by Jordan Jones, isn't it?
It is Jordan Jones. The incredible Jordan Jones, and it's her theatrical debut, and she's phenomenal. And she's only 23, and she's taken on this huge role. She's almost in every scene, and she has monologues that intercut the action as well, where she plays 42 in that. So... It's pretty amazing what she pulls off.
Because one of the things you mentioned there about a woman couldn't go out unchaperoned, for example, and certainly was, to use that awful phrase, the chattel of her husband, and was used as, you know, manoeuvring, whatever, political manoeuvrings, financial manoeuvrings. What Bernini wanted here was he wanted Constanza to be a model for him for a bust, to sculpt a bust. And of course, that involved disrobing, that involved being alone. He didn't want Matteo anywhere near the place, as in her husband. He didn't want, Bernini, the artist, did not want the husband anywhere near the room where she might model. What was the attitude to models at that time in terms of society?
Usually they were sex workers. But in this instance, she was an ordinary citizen, albeit of noble birth. So it was unheard of to be sculpted or carved by a famous sculptor at the time. He only worked to commissions. So the notion of him doing a bust of an ordinary woman was scandalous because it's a juxtaposition, I suppose, in a way, and that's what I found so fascinating. The obsession with celebrity we have now.
I was going to ask you about the celebrity aspect of this.
Everybody wants to be famous. Everybody wants to be noticed on TikTok and Instagram. Everybody is famous in a way. Everybody gets exposure. The last thing a woman in the 1600s in Rome wanted was exposure or scandal or her reputation threatened in any way, shape or form. So she was horrified by this notion and didn't want to go. But her husband, in my play, insists that she does. And then, of course, the limerence starts to gather moss and the obsession, you know, is given oxygen.
And the other aspect of the celebrity side of this in some ways is Bernini was, of course, the big celebrity. And Constanza, initially at any rate, is quite excited about being in the company of this big celebrity.
Yes.
But she's excited about being in the company of this man, not because of his celebrity, but because of her ideas in and around art, running her own art gallery. And interestingly, her idea about the, in inverted commas, Protestant aesthetic versus the, in inverted commas, Catholic aesthetic.
Yes, exactly. And she goes along, in my play, she goes along to, sneaks in under the, you know, the ruse of, oh, I'm bringing dinner to my husband. Oh, is he not here? Where is he? And because she wants to see the paintings on the wall, she wants to look at the books, because she reads.
Yeah.
So it's,
and this is hugely unusual. But even her kind of involvement in the gallery, unheard of, I think.
Selling art, having a real appreciation of art, having an eye for art, self-taught, it was an incredible thing at the time.
Finally, Luigi.
Yes.
The brother.
The brother. Historically, he was a bit of a naughty boy, to say the least. He was done for sexual assault. And his brother was always bailing him out. So he, in my play, I contrive to have him get in the way of the obsession of his brother to save him. But historically, I don't know if that's correct. But that's all I had was a very slight byline on Luigi. So I fleshed him out in a way.
What would you say if you had to take one thing from this 17th century, you know, tale set in both the papacy and in the world of high art? What did that period and the idea of celebrity, how did it feed most into contemporary ideas around celebrity?
Well,
for you?
That for me, it's that nothing has changed, really. Our show opened the day Harvey Weinstein's case was overturned in a New York court. And I thought that was very uneasy, uncomfortable kismet for me. You know, it was that, wow, it was still happening. these guys are still getting away with it. Mm-hmm. All hundreds of years later.
Well, it makes for interesting reading and interesting watching, I'm sure, as well. Celebrity by Elizabeth Moynihan is at the Glass Mask Theatre, in Dublin until Saturday, May the 18th. Glassmarktheatre.com will give you all of the details on that. Now, Villagers released their sixth studio album, That Golden Time, on May the 10th. The Dublin band, of course, first came to prominence with the release of their debut album, Becoming a Jackal. That was in 2010. The album was shortlisted for the Mercury Prize and the Choice Music Prize and won an Ivor Novello Award for Best Song Musically and Lyrically for the title track. That was in 2011. Their second album, Awayland, was also shortlisted for the Mercury Prize and won the Choice Music Prize for Album of the Year in 2013. Darling Arithmetic bagged them their second Ivor Novello in 2016, this time for the Best Album. So, Villagers have won a few awards, I think it is safe to say. 2024 is shaping up to be a special year for Villagers, as along with the new album, they have announced their biggest headline show to date at the Trinity Summer Series in Dublin on June the 29th. But ahead of those two landmark dates, Villagers, also known as Conor O'Brien, of course, will join us live in Studio One in the RTE Radio Centre to launch That Golden Time right here on Arena. And you can join us live for this Villager special at our usual time of 7 o'clock on Tuesday, May the 7th, on here on RTE Radio 1. And will we have a little bit of a listen to Villagers? We will.
That you're telling the truth, but it doesn't line up with my image of you. Would you mind very much if I added some spice, some sugar and cream, and all things nice? There's a twist in your tail that doesn't sit right, a spectrum that dulls the black and white. Well, I've bitten my lip, I've held my tongue, but I'm still here, you lucky one. Your boy, am I such a drag? I could rip you to shreds, but I'm much too nice. So while you're here, take my advice. Don't let the truth get in the way story's a story, and anyway, your foot's in the door, so give me some. Your parasite, your lucky one.
You Lucky One, the title of that track from the upcoming album from Villagers, That Golden Time, the album that we will be launching here in our Villagers Arena special, 7 o'clock on Tuesday, May the 7th, here on RTE Radio 1. Bonnie and Clyde, the musical, is coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre this summer. It will be there from July the 16th through to the 20th. This is the winner of the Best New Musical at the What's On Stage Awards of 2023. The show has now hit the road after two seasons in London's West End. Directed and choreographed by Nick Winston, featuring music by Tony nominee Frank Wildheart and lyrics by Tony and Oscar winner Don Black. The musical centres, of course, on the two well-known ill-fated lovers and outlaws, Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow, whose story has been infamous since they achieved folk hero status during the Great Depression. Let us have a listen to the music. There you go. Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow, or at least the two actors performing those two parts in the trailer for Bonnie and Clyde, which will be coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre this summer. With me in studio now is David O'Reilly, who saw the production in Glasgow King's Theatre. And by the way, if you want to watch proceedings, you can do so on rte.ie/arena. As I was listening to that, in fact, both of us, it has to be said, David, were doing a little bit of bouncing and popping, and there was a fair amount of jazz hands from both of us. Is that the nature of the beast here? Is it, you know, that kind of Charleston dancing, jazz era type of music that we're hearing?
Well, I think what this piece does so brilliantly, particularly with his music, is it sets the tone. You know, so many musicals now loses its identity, particularly with music. But what Bonnie and Clyde does fantastically is has a clear identity with the music. Mm. It takes us back to that deep belly of the 1930s of the South American states, you know, vaudevillian, kind of old repertory theatre vibes. And that actually speaks amongst all the other elements of the production, like the set, and they all marry together just so beautifully. So the music, whilst it sounds bright, cheery, Charleston-y, actually has real moments of darkness as well.
Alright, so there are elements of sadness within all of that as well. Now, obviously, for most people, I think, when they hear Bonnie and Clyde, they'll probably think of the 1967 film Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn. Are we hearing and seeing the same story on stage, or how does it differ?
No, we're not really. And I was actually watching with a colleague of mine, and they were making quite a lot of comparisons to the 1967 movie. And what was interesting was, I think Act One particularly stands alone separately from the movie. It's almost a prologue, really, of where we expect this tale to begin.
We get their kind of backstories, is it?
Yes, and I think what's fantastic about that is it humanises them. We see why they end up the way they are. We see the circumstances, the Great Depression, you know. And what's brilliant is actually what they do in Act One, as I set up beautifully, is they really interrogate the American dream. Do you know what I mean? Where we're in a world where dreams are being stripped apart by poverty, and Bonnie desperately wants to be a movie star, Clyde wants to be famous, and they dive in and take on an aspiration of independence, of notoriety, and they apply them then to recklessness and crime, you know.
How separate, do we get any sense of separate stories in that first act? Are they developing, and you know, separately from each other before the meeting comes that they become Bonnie and Clyde, as opposed to two separate characters?
Very much so. We see Bonnie, particularly her circumstances where her and her mother have had to move back in with her grandmother. We see Clyde break out of prison with his brother, and he's on the run already. That's the first of many times he makes a run out of prison. So instantly we get a sense of them separately, and I think that's really important. Then by the time we get into Act Two, where they are this iconic duo, we have a real sense of each person, each character, each individual. And then we see this explosive duo come together in Act Two and just really turn the story on its head.
Now the second act then, is this where we're closer to perhaps the Bonnie and Clyde story that we all know, the killings, the driving around, the robberies, all of that side of things?
Yeah, this would be where I think most people would associate Bonnie and Clyde, in that world of crime, on the run. And of course, I think the famous finale, shall we say, for both the real people was the shooting and the killing, and how they came to their sad demise, shall we say, their ending. You know, I think that would be the Act Two would definitely be a lot more familiar to people, where they're in the depths of the crime, in the depths of their rise to fame through their, as I said, path of destruction.
What about the society around them? Now, you mentioned, and possibly this is more in the Act One side of things than the Act Two side of things, but the police around them, the society around them that has left them in this absolute mess. How are the haves and the have-nots portrayed? Although in the Great Depression, it was mostly have-nots, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. But we do see elements of, you know, police brutality in there, and seeing that the characters that play Bonnie and Clyde and how they're treated by the law, maybe, and how different they would be treated if that family had money or had, you know, a lot more behind them, shall we say.
They were easy pickings, is there a sense of that?
And I do think that, you know, they played the card of life, and unfortunately they picked a bad card or were dealt a bad card and ended up in circumstances that were beyond that. Maybe had they ended up in different circumstances, they wouldn't have ended up on the path that they inevitably ended up down.
You mentioned that, as when we listened to that little clip of the music from earlier on, that it's not all high octane Charleston. So what is the nature of the music, and is it told with music and acted, you know, spoken sections in between, or is it through composed? How does that side of things work?
There's a fantastic book, which is Pacey, which Nick has really interwoven into the show to really get it moving. And then the songs are so brilliantly plotted throughout.
Nick Wilson, who's the choreographer and director,
And he's actually currently leading the world premiere of Burlesque at the moment. So he knows his meat and his potatoes. He knows what he's doing, you know. So he does a fantastic job of making sure that the piece never feels laboured at any point. And with the songs particularly, they're so well plotted out. And don't forget, this is not the first incarnation of this story. It had a short run on Broadway many years ago. It then came into the West End, but it went into a very small theatre, the Arts Theatre, which sits about 400 people. But that was after a concert, a one-night concert. And it built up a fan base. And then it had a short run at the Garrick. And now it's on a UK tour. So there's been a lot of time to really iron out any creases that the
So that the that development time, which is so essential for a musical that's going to have any kind of longevity, that development time has been given to this piece.
It certainly has, and you can tell because it's a real solid piece, particularly for the book, the script and the composed songs. And I have to say, it's an incredible band orchestra who just instantly take you on a journey straight away. So a special shout out for them, because they just, so many times nowadays, there's so many touring productions happening, you know, and we see so many cuts across the arts. We're limiting down the size of orchestras, where we used to have 40 orchestras, you know, back in the
40-member orchestras, yeah.
42nd Street, when I originally went into Drury Lane, we had a massive orchestra, and now we're seeing them getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And what this band do is they make up the shortcomings with just a real sense of vroom and viper, and it's just fantastic.
I think the production that you saw, the cast members more or less will be the same when the production comes to Dublin.
Yes, they are. We've seen Alex James Hatton and Katie Tonkinson play the two leads, Bonnie and Clyde, and I have to say, they really are.
And they will be playing it in Dublin.
They will be playing it in Dublin, and both are the shining jewels in this crown, this production. Their vocals are to die for. They really, really are, Sean. And I have to say, I was saying earlier on to one of your colleagues that I would say this is hands down the best vocals in any touring production of a musical I've seen recently. They just deliver it with such heartfelt gut. And the acting through song, oh my God, splendid. You know, some people can sing, some people can act, and then there's some people who can marry them
two
together.
The two things
and
together.
My God, do they do it.
I think there's one cast change, and you're familiar with the person who's taking over the new role. Who is she? Is it? Yes.
Yes, Woods-Davis is going to be playing the role of Blanche. Now, when I seen...
And where does Blanche fit into the story then?
Blanche is the sister-in-law of Clyde. She's married to Buck, Clyde's brother. And we see a lot of comedic relief through Blanche, this character. She offers a lot of the one-line liners, the clangers that kind of get the audience back into a sense of, okay, this is actually a musical. And she has a fantastic number called You're Going Back to Jail, which is her talking to Buck with the women in her salon. And it's just a real kind of, it reminded me of, if you remember The Music Man, pick a little, talk a little, cheep, 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 that kind of really kind of lovely kind of gossipy number. It was fantastic. So we're going to have Daisy Woods-Davis. Some people may recognise her from Hollyoaks, and others will recognise her from when she played Carole King recently on the last UK tour of Beautiful. So she's well capable, a very funny actress, and I think she'll be a fantastic addition to Dublin.
So the production that you saw in Glasgow certainly seemed to please you.
It did, and unsuspectingly, because I would tend to be a little bit of glitz and glamour in my musicals. I would tend to like, you know, a little bit more of a well-known piece. I'd maybe lazy. I'm lazy with my taste. But this really, from the minute the orchestra started playing, grabbed my attention, and I was surprised. I was surprised because I generally don't like dark tones, but my God, this was fantastic.
And given that Depression, the Great Depression era setting, and lots of economic parallels, I suppose, often being given in today's world, did you see anything within it that kind of spoke to you in a very contemporary way?
Oh, very much so. You know, when I said earlier on, Bonnie wants to be a movie star and Clyde wants his fame, it just resonated so much with me in a society where so many of us are seeking praise and applause on social media, and the more followers we have. And there's a beautiful scene in Act 2 where they are in the middle of a heist of a bank, and they have their guns up and they're telling everybody to give all their possessions, and one man says, I'm so sorry, could I interrupt you? And he asks them both for an autograph, and it was just fantastic.
The equivalent of the selfie, I guess.
Very much so.
All right, so that's David O'Reilly previewing Bonnie and Clyde, the musical, which will be coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre this summer. It will be there from July the 16th through until the 20th. Full information and booking on boardgoshenergytheatre.ie, and that is our lot for this Monday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Liam Murphy research. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby.